From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. On this week's show, since 2006, Ignite Seattle has given Puget Sounders the opportunity to share their insights into a topic they're passionate about. The concept is simple. Have a great idea, share it. The only catch? You have to do it in front of a packed auditorium in 5 minutes. The 24th incarnation of Ignite Seattle took place at Town Hall Seattle on May 22, 2014. The talks were moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman. Thanks to Sam Kohler for this recording. Tonight's first speaker is Kristen Leong on what bartending and teaching middle school have in common.
Think back with me for a second to 2008, the Great Depression. I want to talk to you guys tonight about the people who were working hard in the face of our country's despair, the people who were helping us cope with the present and think about the future. I'm going to talk to you tonight about bartenders and teachers. And interestingly enough, it was during that Great Depression that I was going through a little confusing overlap where I was both. The thing is, that overlap got less and less confusing once I realized that, in fact, there is significant overlap with my two jobs. I'm going to talk to you guys about three things today. I'm going to start by talking about giving instructions. We're going to do a little compare and contrast of drunk people and people going through puberty. And then we're going to give some thanks. Number one, giving instructions. This is like your primary responsibility as a bartender or as a teacher. And here's the thing, you got to be really clear, you got to be really concise, and it helps if you're a little bit exciting. So when someone comes up to the bar and they're like, I want a gin and tonic and a Heineken and a Long Island, you have to say, stop. We're going to go all the liquor first, and then the beer, and then the wine, and then the non-alcoholic stuff, okay? I'm going to give you a second. Come back when you're ready. Because the thing, drunk people and tweens, like they really want to do the right thing. But they just need some direction. Really clear direction. Here's what you should never do. Don't ever ask a drunk person or a middle school student, what did I just say? They will never know the answer. It's not really their fault. Right? When you're at a club or you're in a classroom, you're thinking about a lot of things. Take a second. Take in everything that's going through their minds. That's no joke. It's a lot going on, right? So drunk people and tweens are a lot alike, right? And it's not really their fault. And there's science to back this up, actually. I want to show you a diagram of the brain of a drunk person and someone going through puberty. And perhaps some of you could relate to one of these guys, right? One or the other, probably not both, right? So here's the thing. There's a significant overlap in the symptoms of intoxication and the symptoms of puberty. And while their tasks may be totally different, like one has to order drinks and the other has to take some notes, the challenges that come up because of these symptoms are really, really similar. Let's talk about memory challenges. I had a seventh grade boy come into my classroom in a panic, asking if we had homework due for our next class. And I said to him, dude, you're not even in my class. And then he looks around and he ran out of the room. You want to know why I was prepared for that? Bartending. Drunk people get lost all the time. Unexpected behavior. For drunk people, that's obvious. For teenagers, it just means that I get to catch kids being the best person they are all the time. Recently, I overheard an eighth grade boy tell a seventh grade boy after his voice cracked in front of the whole class, "It's cool, man. It happens to me all the time." And then there's this. This is a Valentine to me from an eighth grade boy wishing me happy Valentine's Day, hopefully. And then in black and black on the other side, he wrote a Tupac quote, "I don't even know what this means. But this is clearly the best Valentine I have ever received." The thing about teachers and bartenders is that we grumble a lot and we secretly love the people that we serve. And we appreciate your thanks. And maybe that thanks looks a little bit different for bartenders than for teachers. But I'll tell you one thing. For both, high fives are always preferred over hugs. But maybe you make like your own thanks, right? Like maybe you just send that email to your kid's teacher and you CC the principal. "Thank you. That To Kill a Mockingbird unit is blowing my kid's mind. Thank you." And thank you to all of you. I'm Kristen Leong. Find me on Twitter. Send me a high five.
Thank you, Kristen. The future is many things. It is scary, it is unpredictable. And our next speaker, Richard Yonk, is going to tell you how to prepare for it. Richard.
I'm a future geek, and I love it. Terminator scenarios, digital brains, space elevators, tricorders, good or bad, it's all so amazing to think about. But you know what? There are some people who are scared of the future. So today, I want to share with you three simple rules to help you survive the robot apocalypse or bizarre spandex uniforms or anything else the future may bring. That famous futurist John Lennon once said, "Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans." It's a profound statement, isn't it? I mean, whoever looked back on their entire life and said, "Yep, it all happened exactly the way I thought it would." It doesn't happen because no one can predict the future. Except that's not entirely true, is it? Early in our evolution, we acquired the ability to recognize cycles and patterns in our environment, and from that information to anticipate what would follow and then planned accordingly. The ebb and flow of the ocean tides, the annual rhythm of the seasons, the changing phases of the moon and the movement of the stars in the night sky, the subtle shift in the high grass that hinted at someone's next meal. Our gaining this ability went a long way toward making our long-term survival possible. Certainly as individuals, quite possibly for our entire species. My point is that there's a lot of great information out there and we ignore it at our peril. So rule number one is pay attention to what's happening in your world. Patterns and trends are everywhere. Futurists love trends. They're incredibly useful. I'm sure you're all familiar with Moore's Law, which has been driving the computer industry for half a century now. But did you know that trend analysis can be used for lots of things, not just microchips? For instance, in 1977, the year that Elvis Presley died, there were 170 Elvis impersonators in the entire world. By the year 2000, there were 85,000 of them. Now, if we do some quick math, we find that by the year 2043, every single person in the world will be an Elvis impersonator. Now, you may beg to differ, but I think there's a problem with this analysis. This is why futurists use a range of tools, including backcasting, gaming, scenarios, all to get a sense of how the future is developing and how it will ultimately manifest. But if there's one thing futurist thinking teaches you, it's that the future is never certain. So rule number two is always have a good backup plan. Have a good plan B. Have a plan C and D if you want as well. But above all else, never, ever put all of your eggs into one basket. You may not get that raise that you were promised at work. You might not get into your first college of choice. This is why we save for a rainy day and why we apply to more than one university. The future is continually in flux, This is why it's so hard to predict. But on the positive side, this also means we have the ability to influence its outcome ourselves, at least to some degree. So rule number three is identify and strive for your desired future. Be proactive, even if things aren't necessarily going exactly the way that you want them to. You may find that a downturn in the economy or a new technology threatens your business or your livelihood. The answer won't be to stick your head in the sand, but rather to find opportunity in this new environment before your competitors do. Change is inevitable. Our world is being transformed before our very eyes. Robot apocalypse or not, it can be scary. But what's even more scary is letting hope and possibility pass us by. The future is such an amazing place. We should all be visiting it as often as we possibly can, if for no other reason, that it's where we'll find all of our hopes and all of our dreams. This is why I'm so passionate about tomorrow's world. My name is Richard Yonk. I write, consult, and speak about the future. And in closing, I'd just like to say,
thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. Our next speaker is going to tell you a story about bicycles and a photo project that led him to some interesting conclusions. Please welcome to the Ignite stage, Seijin Takamura. Seijin.
My name is Seijin, and I am not a photographer. I have no training in photography whatsoever. But in 2011, I started taking pictures of bicycles, and specifically lonely bicycles. We've all seen them, bikes that have been locked to fence posts, trees, racks, you name it, and are missing things. They're incomplete. They're missing seats, tires, gears, whatever. They're abandoned, forgotten, either by choice or by accident. And so one day I just started taking pictures with my smartphone, thinking it would be a fun way to explore my creative side. And today I've taken over 100 photos of bicycles in their natural habitat. And what I've come to learn is a couple things. One is that these bicycles are literally everywhere, from Seattle to Minneapolis to New York to Chicago to London and Hong Kong and Stockholm. Every city has lonely bicycles. And they may be the single most unifying cultural phenomenon on our planet today. Most of them are just missing tires. So if I have one lesson for the class of 2014, it's lock your front tire. And other things I've learned, like snow and garbage, really help to bring out the lonely factor in the bicycle. This was my first photo taken in Chicago in 2011 when we were undergoing a pretty harsh winter, and I thought it really encapsulated how I was feeling, kind of cold and wet. And in Chicago, it leads me to my next photo, which is this one. It was a particularly transformative one for me because I would pass this bike every day on my way to work, and it never moved. I loved its style, loved its color, and then one day something happened, and that's that the handlebars disappeared. And I thought to myself, who is watching this? Stalking it, waiting to strike in the night. That's kind of creepy, right? And talk about creepy, wait till you get to the next one. This comes from East London. And if you know anything about East London in the late 1800s, this is where Jack the Ripper roamed the streets, violently murdering his victims. And if you pay attention to the back wheel and the front wheel, you'll see the spokes of this bicycle have been meticulously snipped, maliciously, violently. I mean, that's some dark like, seriously. But it's not always that dark. The next photo will give you an example. This is a lonely tire with a handcuff attached to it. Yeah, I don't know. And, on the topic of tires, I found all those missing ones. They're locked to a street post in New York City. So you can go pick them up whenever you want to. And the last story I have comes from Stockholm, where I walked past this next bicycle, and I almost didn't take a photo because it was whole, or seemingly whole, until I looked at the back tire and I noticed that the rim was coming off from the tire, and then there was rust on the frame, and oh, there's this little green plant that's growing through the spokes and into the gears. And I was thinking to myself, man, I feel like an archaeologist that just discovered like an entire dinosaur skeleton, right? Like, this is a whole lonely bicycle. But then I got very sad because I asked myself, like, what tragic event happened where the owner didn't come back to replace it? And so the project really took on a whole new meaning for me over time, and I realized that it wasn't about taking photos at all. I live a pretty hectic lifestyle between my former career in consulting and my current career in startups, and I barely ever have time to stop and reflect on my own life, let alone some piece of crap bicycle that's locked to a street post. But that's exactly what this project has become, an opportunity for me to slow down, to find meaning in the mundane, take notice in the unnoticed, look for beauty in the everyday, and look for the story behind everything. And so the title of this talk was, Can a Bicycle Be Lonely? And I think I can pretty certainly answer, no. It's an inanimate object. It can't feel. It can't think. No. But you are humans, and you can think and feel. And so the next time you see a lonely bicycle, I would ask you to be human and take a couple seconds to ask yourself two questions. How did this get here? And how did I get here? My name is Sajan, and I'm not a photographer. I just like taking pictures of bikes.
Ignite Seattle is the prototype for what has become an international event. The organizers call it an exercise in distilled discovery that leaves you with a deeper sense of the community and possibility that surrounds you. Stay tuned for more distillation in a moment. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. A microphone, your friends and neighbors, perfect strangers, and 5 minutes to share a great idea. It's Ignite Seattle 24. You can probably imagine how scary it could be to give one of these talks. What if it was actually terrifying?
Our next speaker is going to talk to you about what I mentioned at the beginning of the whole show, how scary this is. In a talk titled, Why My Face is Bright Red. Please welcome to the stage, Catherine Downey. Catherine.
So, yeah, this is only slightly less terrifying than I was imagining it would be. I've got the legs feeling like jello, shaky hands, shaky voice, the works. And I know, in reality, that you are all my friends, and you've got drinks in hand, and you're just here for a fun night out. But my brain is pulling this really nasty trick on me, and instead, when I'm looking out, I'm seeing something that wants to attack me and cause serious harm if I make any mistakes. And I know that I'm not alone in having this crazy brain reaction to being the focus of attention. And I wanted to talk today about what other stage fright sufferers can do. First, to understand why this happens to us. Second, how you can prevent it from happening. And third, how you can control the damage if it happens anyway. So step one, knowing your enemy, which, as I already alluded to, is our brain, because my brain is interpreting your gazes as being in imminent danger. And this is triggering the same fight or flight response that you would see across the animal kingdom. Basically, my body right now is revving up and trying to do whatever it can to temporarily boost my strength and my speed. So it accomplishes this by just sending a bunch of hormones, like they're rushing through me right now. And they have a couple missions, the first being to divert as much blood as possible to my muscles, which we'll talk about some of those effects later. Second, it's just trying to kind of raid my biochemical pantry, breaking down fatty acids, doing whatever it can to boost my energy level. And these Hormones have a lot of awesome side effects. This slide illustrates kind of the whole rainbow of fun. Bladder relaxation, no joke. I've been feeling like I need to cross my legs this whole talk. But we'll hang in there. So anyway, bladder. So it feels really hard to control because it is. So the next part of my talk is just thinking of ways where you can take control of contributing factors as much as possible. And everybody's heard practice, and that, you know, it makes sense. If my brain is more confident that I'm not going to screw up, then it's less concerned that I'm going to be viciously attacked. And I also encourage you to combine your practice with a little bit of desensitization, where you first start just, you know, talking to yourself. And then, like, I presented this to my dogs. That was my next step. They loved it. And then just progressively larger audiences. You can also obviously take control of what you put into your body. So the day of your speech, just lay off the sugar and the caffeine, both of which were really hard for me. I've got a bag of Starburst, like, waiting for me when I get off stage. And then obviously you can also take control over what you're wearing. And not only wearing things that make you look good, but also that you're really comfortable in. You know, nothing constricting. This, in retrospect, was overly warm. And not white, because that contrasts with red. Or, yes, with the red face. In terms of keeping your cool, I think that Jennifer Lawrence's faceplant at the Oscars is a perfect illustration of how you can just pull off fails with grace. Amazing grace. She has a superpower. And one thing that I've been doing throughout this talk to help is making eye contact with my husband and other friendly faces in the audience to just kind of anchor myself and remind my brain that I'm not actually in a bad spot right now. This slide is definitely a reference to Happy Gilmore, if anybody else is a fan. And it's just doing whatever you can to give your brain that mental break it needs to collect itself. And I think most important is to not apologize for what's happening, because, like, most of us have this problem. And if you make a big deal about it, then it just overshadows what you're there to say and do. So to tie it all up, I mean, stage fright sucks, clearly. You can try to tame the beast, though, by taking control of whatever you can that contributes to it. And just generally remembering that, you know, even if it strikes and your face is bright red, you just carry on and, you know, Jennifer Lawrence that thank you very much for your attention. And that's all.
Thank you, Catherine. Our next speaker, to any of you who are on a diet, will tell you why your diet will definitely fail. Please welcome to the Ignite stage, Dylan Wilbanks. Dylan.
So last time I was in front of my esteemed panel of jurors was Ignite 8 in 2009. I looked a lot different then. I think I've got a picture. I think I was dressed as a green and white barrel. Yeah, there, that thing there, yeah. So my doctor came to me towards the end of 2012 and said, you're pre-diabetic. You need to do something about that. And being the borderline OCD person that I am, I immediately attacked it with the fervor of a crazy person. I lost 125 pounds between December 2012 and May 2014. And as you can tell, I also lost the ability to smile. So people ask me, so how did you do it? Was it magical Atkins paleo stuff? No, actually it wasn't. I just ate the same things I always did. I just ate less. I ate about 1,600 calories a day. It wasn't any different from my normal diet. I just didn't eat as much. Exercise, on the other hand, I was exercising 6 hours a day. Week. Sorry. I knew I would do that. I couldn't run before. I would almost die. Now I can run a 9-minute mile. So not bad. I also, that OCD thing again, was really, really meticulous about recording every time I went to Weight Watchers, how much I weighed, how far down I went, and all my goals. But on top of all that, I would then turn around and tweet out exactly how much I lost that week in order to keep the accountability up with everybody. So on the whole, not eating as much, accountability, exercise, this all seems to really work well, except that there's this one tiny little problem, right? I'm going to fail. And how do I know I'm going to fail? Because science tells me I'm going to fail. There was a longitudinal study done in 2007, sorry, not longitudinal, a survey of all papers, and they found that one-third to two-thirds of dieters in those papers regained more weight than they lost on their diets. But it gets worse, because you're going to fail just even starting. A 1999 study found that the median success rate for all diets is 15%. That's a 1 in 6 shot, and then a 1 in 2 shot, you're going to gain it all back. Awesome. But wait, this is science, and we have PhDs and dissertations, so clearly we can solve this problem with more studies, right? So we've got the National Weight Control Registry, and it's 10,000 people who have lost weight and kept it off for a year. So what can they tell us? They've surveyed them. Well, 90% of them exercise. The median is 1 hour a day. Okay, so that's 7 hours a week. Okay, what else can we figure out from this? Well, we also know that 78% of them eat breakfast every day. Okay, show of hands, how many of you actually eat breakfast? Well, there's some of you, not me. Okay, what else can we do? 5 out of 8 people, they watch TV less than 10 hours a week. Okay, so 7 hours a week of exercise, eating breakfast, 10 hours and 10 hours a week of media. It's a word for this sort of lifestyle. What is it? Boring. Right. Great. Wonderful. Is there anything else they can tell us? There is one more thing they can tell us. You see, 3 out of every 4 of them do the same thing that I do, which is get on the scale once a week and see how much you currently weigh. So across all those things, it seems like that there's sort of a 4-part plot you can get through that you have your best shot of beating that 15%. Be accountable. Have friends. Have neighbors. Have a group. Tweet it out. Small goals. I worked 1 to 2 pounds a week. Keep it tiny. Next steps, right? Change behavior. I started running. I started exercising. I didn't change my diet to something crazy. I just ate. And the last thing is eat less, move more. Believe it or not, every single diet that people did, that was it. There was no crazy diet, no losing carbs. But most importantly, if you're healthy and you're happy with your weight, please don't go on a diet. Because let me tell you why. Because otherwise, you'll be in front of an entire Ignite crowd with OCD telling people how they should live their lives. And you don't want to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dylan. So also in the category of doing crazy cool things, our next Ignite speaker is going to tell us how to become the 41st best rock band in the world. Please welcome to the stage Daniel Lee.
Okay, so tonight I'm going to tell you a story. And at the end of the story, you're going to have a 3-step guide to achieve any goal that you set out for yourself. And whether you choose to follow this guide or not will ultimately determine whether you succeed or if you fail. So this is a story of how my band became the 41st best rock band in the world. Now I want to clear something up. This is a story actually about Rock Band, the video game. Not a real rock band. So if you don't know what Rock Band is, it's actually a video game that teaches you nothing about how to play real instruments, but it makes you feel awesome and like a rock star. So despite all that, being 41st in the world at Rock Band isn't all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. actually takes blood, sweat, and tears to climb the world ranking of rock. But her whole story actually starts back in college. So my roommates and I started a band. My roommate Derek played guitar. My roommate Greg played the bass. And I played drums and sang. And in rock band, different songs have different difficulty levels depending on what instrument you play. So for a real-life example, Twisted Sisters, Run to the Hills, is pretty easy on the bass, a little harder on guitar, and freaking impossible to play on the drums. It's so hard, right? So we decided to all play different instruments so we could help each other out. And that brings us to our first point, which is you have to build a great team. So surround yourself with people with a complementary skill set to you that can actually support you through those tough songs and those tough times. So now that our band was formed, we started playing. And just like anything you do starting out, the first time you do it, you're the worst you will ever be at that thing. So we started playing Rock Band. When we first started, we were terrible. We sucked. We failed. And we failed a lot. And when you fail at Rock Band, you are literally booed off the stage. And no one likes getting booed off the stage, even if it's by digital, pseudo-fake fans that don't even exist. But through that really traumatizing and humiliating experience, we actually learned something really interesting, is that the faster we failed, the faster we got better. And the faster we got better, the faster we actually were able to achieve our goal. So that's the second step here, is you have to fail fast. Because the faster you learn, the faster you get there, and the faster you are to achieving whatever you set out to achieve. So we started playing, and we started getting better. And when we started getting better, we got into it. I mean, we got, like, really into it. Like, it was bad. We played every single day between class and soccer practice. It was like a job. We would clock in, we would rock out, we'd clock out, go to practice. So just to illustrate how committed we were to playing Rock Band, one time we were playing Deep Purple's. This is a Deep Purple song, and during the middle of the song, there's a lot of drumming, there's a lot of foot pedaling, so I'm literally just slamming the drums as hard as I can. Halfway through the song, snap the drum right in half, snap the foot pedal, break it like a twig. But not only did I break it, the drums, I actually pulled my hamstring as well. So here's our third point. You have to commit wholeheartedly to what you're setting out to do. Fully commit yourself, your mind, your body, and your soul to your goal. So over the next 2 years, we were committed, we played, we climbed actually the world ranking online all the way up to 41st in the world. Yep. Thank you. Yeah, but today I work for a fast-growing startup here in Seattle, Porch, and I use this same exact guide every single day to achieve my goals, whether they're professional or they're personal. The same three steps apply universally across everything. So again, the three steps are you got to build a great team, you got to fail fast, and you have to commit wholeheartedly to what you're doing. And so I've had a great time sharing my story with you, but I mean, this story is really not about me, but it's actually about you. So I've been fortunate enough to find something I can be 41st in the world at. And it would be cheesy of me to stand up here and say, you can be the best in the world at anything. But I bet you can be 41st best in the world at something. So I just want to leave you with this. Like, what is that something for you, right? What is your rock band? So thanks a lot. My name is Daniel. Rock on.
Thank you, Daniel. Our next speaker is going to tell you a story about how words become real that also happens to be about syphilis. Please welcome to the stage Jennifer Wetham. Jennifer.
So as tonight's story is not so much a story about syphilis as it is a story about a man who lived 400 years ago who it put a word into our collective minds and made it stick there for centuries. Now, syphilis during that time period was a pretty big problem because it was untreatable and it made your nose rot off. And this is a prosthetic nose, circa 16th, 17th century, that people would use to hide the unsightly defect. And this right here is an early grafting technique to fix your nose after the leprosy-like impact of untreated syphilis. So when syphilis swept the continent in 1495, it didn't have a name, which I think made it probably a lot scarier. And people called it the French disease or the Great Pox, because to differentiate from smallpox. And the reason they called it the French disease or the Neapolitan disease was because when the French soldiers invaded Naples, that's when the first outbreak occurred. And this went on. Syphilis was called the French disease in Italy, Poland, and Germany, the Italian disease in France, and so on. So pretty much if we hate you, you gave us syphilis. Super fun. Which leads us to some questions that you may not have thought to ask. What is the origin of the word syphilis, and when did we first start calling it syphilis? And this is actually where our real story starts, and I give you Verona in 1530. Stage fright. Here's our real hero, Girolamo Fracastro. And this is a painting done by Titian, which the historical rumor is that Titian actually had syphilis and that he exchanged this portrait for treatment. Now, Fracastro was a doctor, and doctors in 1530 were not the most highly respected of people. Part of this was because astrology was sort of the governing paradigm. And while they knew that syphilis was a sexually transmitted disease, they didn't quite understand what happened, like after you screwed someone, how you got screwed. And so this is a picture of a syphilitic patient, and it's attributing the cause to astrology. So Fracastro's theory was kind of like booed by the other doctors, and it was this idea that there were these little fomites, that things, these little atoms, or they didn't have that word, you know, would stick to your clothes and they'd get to somebody else. And so Fracastro had this problem, and it's a postmodern problem, you know, like, how do I make my tweets go viral? So Fracastro had this idea, like, how do I make my germ theory go viral? So we're going to stop for a second, and I'm going to give you my English 101 little lecture. Genre is, what is the best form in which to shape and spread an idea? That's genre. And rhetoric is a question that we've all asked, how do I get people to see the world the way that I do? And then finally, technology. And technology is a dictic term, which means that its meaning changes based on what it's referring to. So technology could be this microphone, technology could be this lovely laptop, technology could be a pencil. And sometimes genre and technology get blurred or combined in interesting ways. You know, so Twitter, for example, is a technology and it's also a genre. So Fracastro's choice was unusual for doctors. Doctors did not go around writing epic poems, but Fracastro, to spread his ideas about germ theory, wrote an epic poem that starred an unlikely hero, a shepherd, wait for it, named Syphilis. And syphilis somehow angered Apollo, the god Apollo, and Apollo struck him down with a horrific disease. And that, my friends, is where we get the name syphilis. So you might be wondering what the point of all of this is. Great story, Jen. But Fracastro's rhetorical risk paid off. His image is now ensconced in stone. His ideas gave way to germ theory, and now we still call syphilis. It's firmly entrenched in our minds. Thank you.
Stay tuned after this quick break for more presentations from Ignite Seattle. You won't want to miss it. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. You're listening to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Now, back to Ignite Seattle's Monica Guzman.
So we find similarities in all parts of life. Our next speaker will tell you what Star Wars and Islam have in common. Please welcome to the stage Hussein Rasa. Hussein.
I'm in a cave surrounded by nothing but a haunting darkness. As I walk towards the emptiness, I come across a window, and as I raise my heels and the courage to look in, what I see I wish upon no man, my father frozen in carbonite. I feel a dark presence behind me, and I turn. I must have had this dream over and over and over again from the age of 5. You see, I grew up in Dubai in the 80s and the 90s. It was much like growing up on Tatooine. It was barren, it was hot, and people in robes often try to sell you junk. There wasn't much to do, and because it was so hot and there was no such thing as internet, we spent a lot of time watching old TV shows and movies, and one of them I happened to have was Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. And so watching that over and over again, naturally, living in a Muslim country, I began to see similarities between the two. And so I'm going to share some of those with you. Let's talk about Yoda. Yoda says that the force, it surrounds us, it binds us. So in Islam, we believe that Allah is that oneness, that source of all force. And so his omnipotence and his omnipresence is what we try to make a connection with. And when that connection is made, we begin to have the secrets of the universe be revealed to us. See, it's like in Islam, we're told that if you want to change the outward, do not try by changing the world, but try to change yourself within, because whatever's happening around us is actually manifesting from the hidden world within. And it's from there, from the secret world of the heart, from where all actions spring. Yoda says that luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. Well, in Islam, Allah, also known as the light, blew of us of that light. And so we are also luminous beings. Let's talk about the Jedi. During my research, I found out that George Lucas derived the term Jedi from the Muslim term Jedi, which stands for the Masters of the Mystical Warrior Way. These Jedi train a lot like the Jedis of the Star Wars universe in a master-apprentice relationship. And they start by, guess what? By cleansing their inward from the diseases of the heart, whether it be jealousy or envy or anger or hatred. You must all know this man, Jalaluddin Rumi. He was a 13th century Muslim scholar. And one of his quotes was, "I'm not this hair, I'm not this skin, I'm the soul that lives within." And so these are the practitioners of what Rumi preached that exist to this day. And a lot of their regimen, it starts with cleansing that inward from the diseases of the heart that block that light from that connection that leads to the unseen world. Well, let's talk about the Jedi. The Sith. The Sith are what? They were Jedis that gave in to their materialistic side and ignored their spiritual essence. And so they gave in to these diseases of the heart. But like Yoda said, like fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hatred. Hatred leads to suffering. I'm sorry if I messed that one up. Islam's no different. We have our own version of the Sith. And I'm sure you're familiar with them. They're on TV every day. The Taliban or Boko Haram, which have been in the news. Well, these people, their actions have nothing to do with Islam. Nothing. I mean, even when they're called Islamists, they have nothing to do with Islam. It's funny to us when we hear that as Muslims, that they're Islamists. You know, the extreme of something that's good that can only be good. And their actions where they're going around killing people and decapitating men and women or children, there's no room for that in Islam. I mean, the Quran clearly states that killing one innocent person is like killing entire humanity. I mean, there's a quote of the Prophet where he said that if you reach your place of rest and you have an animal with you, it is your duty upon you to first feed that animal before you feed yourself. Let's talk about Yoda. Yoda has been alive for 900 years in the Star Wars universe and has been training Jedi for millennia. And when he meets Luke for the first time, he says, I cannot train you because you have this boy has no patience. When in Islam, the Quran talks about Khizr, or Prophet Khizr, whose name stands for the Green One. He lived for a period of over 900 years and was also tasked with training those who were spiritual ready. When he came across Moses, there's an incident where he comes across Moses and he says, oh Moses, I cannot train you because you will never have patience with me. That's all the time I have today. I hope you enjoyed it. And thank you for hearing me out. And also I'd like to thank George Lucas. I think he did a better job depicting Islam than anything I've seen on the media. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Hussein. Let's welcome to the stage David Halton, who's going to tell us what happens when hackers go outside. David.
In 2007, I went to my first outdoor hacker conference. And it was located at a former Soviet airbase outside of Berlin. And so they're kind of similar to indoor hacker conferences, except for, well, how often can you speak inside of an underground airplane hangar, right? So really awesome spaces. And a lot of people will say that these events are kind of similar to like a nerd version of Burning Man. The only difference is that these events, for example, the one that I went to, laid over 7 kilometers of fiber to get internet there. Another difference, hackers want to have connectivity and be able to talk to each other, and these remote places sometimes don't have cell phone service, so they made their own cell phone network and to support the thousands of people there. So how awesome is it that you can pull out your phone and dial beer, and beer just magically arrives? So the one thing that I took away from this whole experience is that even though it was thousands of people at this event, it felt like a very intimate sort of place where you're really like visiting people's neighborhoods and they were inviting you into their camps and having really meaningful conversations. And so this was really a life-changing experience. And just some background on me, I've been organizing hacker conferences in the U.S. since the late 90s. And so I came back and I really wanted to start experimenting with this and like start running conferences and things other than convention centers and hotels. So we started a version of our conference, TourCon, here in Seattle at nightclubs and bars to try that out. And one of the conferences that we ran, our keynote speaker got up on stage and he pointed out that there's this Titan One missile silo available for sale on eBay. And he tried to rally the audience to, you know, put together, save up all their pennies to afford this $1.5 million missile silo. And for what purpose, you might ask? To have a hacker conference there, of course, right? So just by pure chance, I ended up running into the guy that owned this missile silo a few months later. And he gave me a tour, and it was a pretty amazing space. So we ended up actually having the first American hacker camp, outdoor hacker conference there. And we had talks in the same operation dome that used to house the computers and the big red button that could send the nukes. We also had lots of cool workshops. One, for example, is we had the founders of MakerBot Industries there with their first prototypes off the line in 2009, and they were showing people how to do 3D printing back when it was first, you know, coming out of its infancy. So, but another thing is that we also had Ignite talks there. And so I think it's fairly safe to say that we had the first Ignite lineup that actually happened at a missile silo. So I'm fairly certain nobody else has done this, but if, you know, feel free to correct me. So fast forward 3 years, we organized our second hacker camp, and this was out at the Hoboken Beach Resort in Nia Bay, slightly better conditions than the last one. And this was a really fun event to put together. We built this 50-foot geodesic dome ourselves, and made this really cool cover for it out of used Clear Channel billboard ads, thanks to their dumpster. Thank you, Clear Channel. And it was just great. We had amazing speakers. People could hang out like on the grass and watch these talks. We set up great areas for people to like hack late into the night, give talks and workshops, and it was really just an amazing time. And we had some really great projects that came out of this. One project, for example, is we had some group that put together a cell phone network because there wasn't really any cell phone reception out there. and also a payphone network, I guess. We also had a group that hacked an arcade game with fog machines and lights that went crazy and stuff. We had high-voltage Tesla coil weapons, food hacking competitions, playing music with bananas. If you wanted to, you could get an RFID implanted into your hand. All sorts of cool projects that people took on. One of the coolest, though, I think, is that this local group, Hackerbot Labs, took the laser diodes out of a projector, just an $800 Casio projector, and overdrove them and shot it into space and got FAA approval and everything. And from a few miles away, we just drove out there, took a picture of it shooting through the clouds. And so with this picture, I just want to leave you with this and encourage all of you to shoot for the stars and really check out one of these life-changing, amazing conferences. There's a few in Europe. There's also one here in the U.S., which is coming up right after 4th of July. And more information is at tourcon.org. Or you can check us out on Google Maps or Google Earth. And just for the record, I have no idea how we got on there. Thank you.
Thank you, David. So if there's one thing that anyone who's ever made accounts on, you know, websites anywhere knows, it's that passwords are a huge pain. Our next speaker, Arkady Kanter, is going to tell us how passwords can be less miserable. Arkady, please come to the stage.
Well done. So you might have heard there was a little bit of a security issue on the internet recently known as Heartbleed. And for those of you who didn't, the gist of it is that it was an unfortunate exploit in a popular open source piece of software that was used around many, many, many websites on the internet. And the really, really insidious thing about it is if you were attacked through the use of Heartbleed, you had no way to tell that you had been attacked. So if you knew you were vulnerable, you just kind of had to assume that all your stuff was lost. So a lot of system administrators had a really bad day when they found this out. But a lot of users had a bad day too, because it turns out that they had to assume that everything had changed too, so they had to change all their passwords everywhere. So if you're like me, changing your passwords everywhere is like being told to stick a fork into your eyeball. Because first of all, I don't remember all my passwords everywhere. And second of all, once I do change all my passwords, the next time I go to that website, I don't remember what I changed it to. So I think there are ways for us to do better in terms of how we deal with passwords. And there are some things that you can already do today. For example, you can use a password manager, something like LastPass or 1Password. Yeah, LastPass. So password managers basically let you create a unique and secure password for every site that you care about, and then you go in and you, when you go to the site, it'll populate the password for you, you click sign in, and it's magical and wonderful. So you do that, you have all your passwords there, so now you can easily change all your passwords, right? No, you can't, because they just store your passwords. They don't really manage them. There's no way for you to actually change your passwords through LastPass. So, okay, plan B. I'm going to sign in everywhere with my Facebook account, right? Well, you know what? That's great, because now you have 1Password you have to worry about. But the downside is that now you have all your eggs in 1 basket, and I think somebody earlier said you shouldn't do that. So maybe that's good enough for you, but it's not good enough for me, because first of all, I don't want all my eggs in 1 basket, and second of all, if you guys find a bank that lets you sign in with your Facebook account, you let me know. Right? So what can we do that's actually better? Well, I think we can make a common password interface. And by that, I don't mean that we make it so that every website has a change password link in the same place, and then you click it and you follow the same 12-step process. I mean a common password interface in the programming sense, which is to say an API, where I can make an app that can go in and it can make the same call to Facebook, the same call to Twitter, the same call to Google, the same call to Yahoo, to change your password in the same general format. And with that, you can actually create a awesome, much like next level, leveled up LastPass that can go in and change all your passwords and manage your passwords. Right? So with that, you need two things if you're going to think about that. First of all, you need that API to be secure, right? All of these sites integrate with a half dozen apps, and the vast, vast majority of those apps, You don't want them to be able to change your password. You don't want the random thing you just signed up for on Facebook by accident to be able to change your Facebook password. So you need to actually limit the apps that can change your password for you. Hopefully that's just your password manager. But, you know, maybe you have a couple of things that you want to use, something on your phone, something on your computer. The second thing you want is you need it to be self-describing, because every website thinks they're a unique snowflake in terms of how they want your passwords to be, right? Some of them want 8 characters exactly, some of them want 22 characters and 3 of them are in Japanese. So if you're going to make an app that's going to set your password and change it, you want to make it so that it can figure out what the requirements for that password are, and then follow those requirements. So if you build an API that follows those two traits, now you can go and build an app. And that app is going to be able to go in and manage your passwords for real this time. Shocking, right? So the good news is that once you've done that, now you can approach the holy grail of password management. A single big red panic button that you press when you hear about something like Heartbleed, and you say, change all my passwords, and presto whammo, you're secure. So here's the downer that I'm going to end this on. The hard part about all this is adoption. In order to have a common password interface, you have to convince a bunch of companies to do work to implement this kind of password interface before you actually can build the app. But we're the consumers, and we have power to give the companies that care our attention. And so I think it's only going to be 3-4 more Heartbleed class bugs before this happens, guys. I think if we all start today, we can make it happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Arkady. Our next speaker is going to tell you how a story about bestiality, trolls, and laundry taught her some valuable lessons. Please welcome to the stage Abigail Anderson. Abigail.
You thought that it'd be easy. Check things off the list and you'd be happy. But here you are nearing 30, even more restless than before. I wrote my first song when I was 5. I spent the next 20 years trying to find anything else to be good at. Until, at about 25, I ended up as the world's worst receptionist in Seattle and realized that if I was going to get paid shit money, I should do something that I was good at. So I quit my job. And for a while, it was great. And then it was like Wile E. Coyote looking down and realizing that there's no ground underneath it anymore. And I failed in the most emotionally and financially stressful manner possible, and then I did what every good musician does, and I ran from my feelings. And it was while I was in this state of trying to do anything to feel better that, for whatever reason, this weird story that a mentor had told me a couple years ago, set in Norway, came to mind. And it's about a girl that marries a polar bear. And one night, she decides that she wants to make sure that it's not really a polar bear that's sleeping next to her, and she sneaks in a candle. And it turns out that by trying to make sure that she's not sleeping with an animal, she's triggered this awful curse where what turns out to be a prince has to go and marry a troll, which is a fate worse than death in Norwegian folklore. And so the castle is disappearing, and she's grabbing onto him. She says, I'm going to go rescue you. And he's like, yeah, that's not going to happen. But just in case, I'm going to be east of the sun, west of the moon. Good luck. And everything disappears. Not really knowing how to get east of the sun, west of the moon, she goes to the nearest neighbor and says, hey, do you know how to get to the Troll Queen's castle? And she says, yeah, you're never going to make it, but here's this gold thing I have lying around, and try the neighbor. And the next neighbor has another gold thing and sends her to the next neighbor who has another gold thing, who sends her to the east wind, who sends her to the south wind, who sends her to the west wind, who sends her to the north wind, who actually blows her all the way to this castle, only to discover that the prince has been drugged. Thankfully, she has all those gold things tucked away with which to bribe herself into the castle. And so she's crying over the prince, trying to get him to wake up so she can rescue him, and he doesn't, but there's people nearby who let him know. And then finally, they come up with this plan because he has this shirt that she got candle wax on. And trolls are known as not clean creatures. And so he says, I can't marry you unless you can clean my shirt. And she can't. And the trolls are so angry, they all explode. Which then leaves the polar bear prince and the princess with two whole kingdoms and not a whole lot of stress. So there's a couple things that I learned from this story. The first one is to just move forward. When the shit's hitting the fan, we want to run for the shower, when we should start with turning off the fan. For me, this meant getting out of bed and putting on clothes and checking Craigslist. The next very important lesson that I learned, and this is, if anybody's an artist or any kind of a creative, this is essential. People don't have to believe in you to help you. I, much like the hero in that fairy tale, heard you're never going to make it fairly often. But there was sometimes some good advice right after that, or at least a free meal. So in the face of cynicism, pay attention to what's going to help you get to your next goal and just ignore the rest. Finally, and most importantly, what I learned from this weird little fairy tale is that failure is an invitation to adventure. In fact, thank you. In fact, it's your failure that's going to prepare you for success. If I had gotten everything that I wanted, maybe I would have had a couple more, well, money at all in the bank. But because I failed, I have been flown across the country to sing at conferences. I have met amazing people, and I have been prepared to accept what happens with me with grace. And I've written some pretty good songs. Broken bones get stronger. Broken hearts grow larger. Security's a fantasy. So walk into the woods with me and we'll see where these dreams take us. Past all we thought might break us into the heart of darkness. Carrying a spark of light. Carrying a spark of light. Thank you.
Thank you, Abigail. So it's no secret that our politics are flawed, not the least of which is our system for public initiatives. Our next speaker, Jan Gray, is going to talk about how that can get better. Jan.
So I'm really excited to be here, and I would love to tell you everything there is to know about Washington State initiatives, but fortunately for both of us, there isn't time. Initiatives started in Washington State over 100 years ago because folks believed that their legislature was in the pocket of big business and the wealthy. Anybody catch a little irony there? The initiative spending in Washington State has skyrocketed. And in 2010, a record was set that we haven't come anywhere near close to since, of over $60 million being spent on five initiatives. One of those initiatives was the first attempt of Costco to privatize liquor sales. Another one was the two-thirds majority And then in 2011, we spent about $39 million finally passing the privatization of liquor and also removing the tax on candy and sodas. So, great benefit there. The initiative in 2012... last year in the November election, another record was set. When the state saw the expenditure of over $28 million against an initiative. When you're spending that much money, it's clearly not a grassroots project anymore. In fact, it costs about $1 million just to get the signatures you need to get on the ballot. So what does an initiative do anyway? Lots of times very good things, but finding out what they are is a real challenge. The Office of Financial Management has a responsibility of putting an impact statement in the voter's guide. And if you just look at the bottom two lines of this, you will see what I saw time after time after time as I looked at initiatives in the voter's guide. The impact is indeterminate, but not zero. That doesn't help me much. Also, initiatives have a tendency to conflict with existing legislation, and that candy and soda initiative is one of the ones that removed a tax that had almost just been passed in Washington State. Another initiative was the class size initiative, which passed but hasn't been able to be funded yet, and there's a very good chance it'll be on our ballots again in November. So what can we do? Well, a group of us got together and decided that what we could do is make good and sure that accurate, unbiased information came to the voters about Washington initiatives. So Responsible Choices decided that we're going to create the first Citizens Initiative Review in Washington State. It's happening in Oregon. It's working in Oregon. We're going to try it here. We gathered together about 25 citizens from all over Washington State who match voters in Washington demographically, geographically, and kind of therefore, as a result, politically. They are going to spend up to 4.5 days learning everything they ever dreamed they wanted to know and probably more about initiatives. They're also going to learn the deliberative process, how to ask open-ended questions, how to press for answers. And then both sides of the committees on one particular initiative will present their stories to them, take questions, and then rebut each other's stories. They'll also have a chance to kind of subpoena their own experts. So maybe they'll choose a constitutional lawyer or an economist who's willing to take a risk and make some projections. After all that, they're going to deliberate, make a decision, and vote on the initiative they've looked at. They'll write a majority and a minority statement that gets at why the initiative is important, what the key factors are, and why they voted the way they did. Then it will be our responsibility to get that information in front of the legislature and in front of Washington voters. And if you want to learn more, please go look at our website at responsiblechoiceswa.org.
Thank you, Jan. All right, we've got a political two-parter here for you. If any of you think you may someday run for office, pay attention to the next speaker. Noelle Frame is going to tell you a few tips on how to do that. Noelle.
There's an adage that little girls don't dream of growing up to be president of the United States. Well, that didn't apply to me. I've got my White House dreams clocked as early as second grade. Now, you may think we're born this way, that we come out with our flag pins and our blind ambition, and with shows like Scandal and House of Cards, I can hardly blame you. But I'd like to think I'm less Frank Underwood and more Leslie Knope. Leslie and I have quite a few things in common. Overly optimistic, slightly OCD, and we ran for office the same year. Yes, 2 years ago, I took my first steps towards my White House dream. But truth be told, I actually started long before that. So tonight, I want to pull back the curtain and tell you how you can prepare to run for office in 4 easy steps. And this is the kind of advice I give to candidates every day as part of my job at Progressive Majority Washington. First, pick your community and stay there. And while you're at it, find one where you can actually win. Okay, I grew up in Battleground, Washington, rural, conservative. I didn't have a chance there. And I ended up in Seattle, and I ended up in Ballard, and I stayed there. Now, I've moved 4 times since 2005. One deal breaker. It had to be within the lines you see behind me. It's really important that you lay down your roots, because why would you rip those up every time you move? The second thing you need to do is get involved in your community and do something you're passionate about. Because honestly, if you're not that interested, it's gonna show. Now, for reasons I cannot begin to explain tonight, when I was 25 years old, I ended up as the primary caretaker for my 16-year-old cousin. I had no idea what I was doing, okay? No idea. And I'm like, you know, I should join the PTA, because there's going to be moms there, and they're going to know what to do. And thankfully, they were very generous with their advice. And when I joined the PTA, albeit under weird circumstances, it really reignited in me that passion I'd always had for public education. And I got involved, and I went to conferences, and I met lots of great folks, and they helped me on my campaign later. Make your interests known. Make sure the people in the know who you are. And make sure that they know you want to run for office. Now, you may have heard of the smoke-filled room, okay? Well, there are people who think about these things, like me, and we meet in a room, but not a smoke-filled one. Come on, it's Washington, duh, okay? But really, you need to get your name out there so you're on that list. And ladies, listen up. You have to tell other people you want to run. Because if you don't, you'll probably talk yourself out of it when the time comes. Women have to be asked 3 times, typically, before they agree to run for office, and that even included me. Finally, be ready to capture opportunity. You do not want to waste time doing things you could be doing right now when that opportunity comes. So listen to me, hoard those business cards. Get your contacts in electronic format, and for God's sake, go by your domain name. I own noelleframe.com, .org, .net, .us. Now, when the time came, I was ready, I captured opportunity. And as a candidate, I had 2 jobs, raise money and talk to voters. Raising money for me was the best excuse to talk to everybody I knew on earth. And I ended up raising $160,000 for more than 700 people. And voters are awesome. I knocked on more than 10,000 doors. I literally had a dude try to set me up with his grandson. Like, come on, that's great. And I'm happy to report, I made it through the primary, beat 5 other candidates to get through the primary. And when I got to the general, I won, as you might have guessed, 31,273 votes. But my opponent won more, and a lot more. I lost by 11 points, yeah. But you know what? It was okay. I loved every single minute of it, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. I didn't actually like everything. I didn't like gaining 35 pounds and going totally crazy, but you get my point. And you know, sometimes you have to run more than once in order to win. Even Barack Obama lost once. So if I haven't totally scared you and you're thinking maybe you might want to run for office, I hope you'll find me at Progressive Majority Washington, because I would love to help you get ready to run for office. I'm Noelle Frame. Thank you.
Thank you, Noelle. Our next speaker has been on 1 or 2 nonprofit boards, and she's going to tell you what you wish you'd known before you joined a wonderful nonprofit board. Please welcome Karen Anderson.
I know you. You're smart. You're talented, and you're successful. So it's just a matter of time before a nonprofit board that you really like asks you to give them a hand. And this could be the beginning of a beautiful relationship or the start of the relationship from hell. Listen carefully. They're going to say to you, "We know you're good at fundraising," and that means they have termites in the clubhouse. They're going to tell you you've got people skills, which means their board chair is at odds with their executive director. Be careful. I'm going to talk tonight about some of the things that you should be looking out for when the nonprofit boards come around and are looking to work with you and all of your talents. First of all, what do boards actually do? Governance, delegation, fundraising, and oh my God, is this sexy or what? So it's not quite what you thought. They want to know what you bring, and this is what they're looking for. They never ask people who have these skills. They just ask their friends. So do yourself a favor. Unless you have a couple of those skills, put it off until later. Otherwise, everyone will be unhappy. And did I mention, 100 hours a year minimum is what the consultants estimate that you will be spending if you work with a board, and they always have their retreat on your spouse's birthday. Is this the board for you? What I'm going to do tonight is help you figure out if these are the people you want to spend 100 hours a year with. We're going to look at some of the key things that you need to ask. What are their goals? What are their problems? The problems are important because their problems are going to be your problems. You also want to get a copy of that plan and read it. The other things you want to do is don't just ask the board. Ask all these other folks, particularly the ex-board members. Boy, do they tell you some great stories. I'm going to go over a few of the specific questions that you want to ask and some really scary things to be alert for. First of all, what direction are they going? What speed are they going? Do they have a lot of competitors? Are they breaking into uncharted territory? And is that the sort of thing that you want to do? How do they handle those problems? Everyone has problems. But some boards are confrontational. Some of them sweep it all under the carpet. Make sure that whatever their problem-solving style is, that it's something that really works for you. Hostage situations. Boards often have a founder, a major donor, or a board member who is a bully. Do not join one of those boards unless you want to become a hostage negotiator. This is related to it. For reasons that begin in kindness and convenience, boards have a tendency to hire in staff positions and contractor positions their friends and their families. This is an ethical problem that you do not want to take on. Read the Washington Nonprofit Handbook. It's a free download from the Secretary of State. It'll tell you all about the best practices and what happens to boards that don't follow them. Now we're going to look at another book. Those are the board bylaws. Most boards have not read their own bylaws, and most boards are out of step with them. Ask for a copy of the bylaws and read it. You'll be glad that you did. Do they have financial problems? And they may be well run. They may be adhering to all the best practices. But if there are external forces, they've lost a major grant, taxes have gone up on their building, they're going to be in trouble and you need to know about it. Finally, are their expectations of you realistic? If you work for Microsoft, they think you're going to solve all their financial problems. I am not kidding. They may think you have endless amounts of time to spend fixing their website. Make sure that you're all in sync, and make sure that you know what your own goals are. Can you provide expertise? Can you raise money? Can you build community relationships? You should also have some goals for yourself as an individual, because being on a board is going to change you. You're going to develop some wonderful skills. These may change what you do in your career, and they may even change what you do with your life. I hope that you go into this with an open heart. I hope you also go into it with your eyes open. I want it to be a great experience for you and also for the board that's lucky enough to have your skills and talent. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Our next speaker is going to tell us how you need words to build world-changing ideas. Please welcome to the stage Lindsay Ng. Lindsay.
Hi. Tonight, I'm going to talk about ideas. Why are ideas so important? Why do we place so much darn emphasis on ideas? The great Leonardo DiCaprio in Inception tells us, that ideas are more viral than the world's most devastating disease. Because once that idea takes hold in someone's mind, it becomes a part of their personal identity and changes them. Ideas can be world-changing, and you need three things in order to create ideas. The first one is community. Ideas don't form in light bulb moments. Ideas form when smaller hunches bump into other smaller hunches and form bigger hunches that lead to big ideas. The second ingredient that you need is space. Communities need gathering space, and that space needs to be well-designed for collaboration and connection, like co-working spaces or churches. And the last ingredient that you need for world-changing ideas, and the most important one, is words. Words help to clear a pathway through the chaos of the jungle, so to speak. Words help to define our current reality and what we know. For example, let's talk about dream jobs. When I was a kid, I went through a number of different phases. I wanted to be an astronaut, a doctor, a teacher, but mostly I wanted to be a Disney princess. So fast forward a couple years, and I get a little bit older, my vocabulary expands, and I realize that Disneyland is not the only thing out there, and I'm in Greenland. As I was learning the local Inuit language, there was one word in particular that I kept on tripping over, and that word was ice. As I later learned, that's because there's over 50 different words for ice in the Inuit language, which meant that as I was learning those new words for ice, I kept on seeing new different types of ice. So, fast forward a couple years, and as I continued to search for my dream job, I kept on searching for my dream job in sectors that I was most familiar with. I thought that I had left my Disney World long behind, but in reality, I was just searching to become a different version of a Disney princess, basically Ariel turning into Belle. I kept on searching for my dream job in sectors that I was most familiar with because that was what I had words for. So in my quest for finding a dream job, that ice analogy really stuck. Basically, I kept on thinking, what other types of ice, metaphorically, was I not seeing because I just didn't have the word for it yet? What role do words play in a global context? Words help to facilitate world change by providing the infrastructure in which world-changing ideas can grow. Words that are most effective in creating that cultural change are easily accessible and easily translatable, like a buzzword. For example, let's take our business culture. About 50 years ago, not the sole reason, but the big reason for having a business was the creation of profit. And the really only growth pattern in creating a business was more profitability. Fast forward 20 years, and we had the buzzword, social enterprise coined. A social enterprise is basically a company with a double or triple bottom line, a company that has a less linear value proposition than a typical business. So does that mean that social enterprises just didn't exist before this buzzword was coined? Well, no, but that buzzword did help give rise to a more public conversation and a new trend in business. And now, 10 years later, we've seen a growth rate of over 400% self-identified social enterprises giving rise to a new trend in business and helping more traditionally corporate companies think about business and profit in a totally different way. This buzzword has also given rise to a number of other buzzwords like SROI or microfinance, creating new opportunity areas for others to innovate within, changing the business culture from the inside out, all because of one buzzword. So, what's the takeaway from all of this? Words help to facilitate big ideas by providing the infrastructure in which world-changing ideas can grow. It's hard to see new things or do new things without words. So the next time you want to create or change the world, create a buzzword that sticks. And if you want to be more convinced, I'll give you the selfie. In order to drive the point home more, I want to take my first selfie with all of you. So if you could all please stand up. Thank you.
All right, guys, with that, we have just one more talk, and it's a rare treat. It's two people giving one Ignite talk. Noah Ilinsky and Teresa Valdez-Klein have each given their own talks before on the Ignite stage. They met at Ignite, and now they're going to present what I think will be a very memorable Geek's Guide to Wedding Planning. Noah and Teresa.
I'm Noah. I attended the very first Ignite Talks ever here in Seattle, and I spoke for the first time in 2008. Teresa was there. We did not meet.
I gave my first Ignite Talk in May of 2011, and that is how I met Noah. My first talk was about how the wedding industrial complex likes to create this sense of scarcity around love so that you'll buy stuff, and how it makes people who are single feel really, really crummy. So we wanted to take a minute before we dove into this wedding-themed talk to give a shout-out to the single people here tonight. This is not about throwing you a bouquet and telling you you're next. This is about telling you you're perfect just the way you are. Yeah.
So I loved how Teresa spoke about scarcity and commodification of these things. I introduced myself. We had brunch a couple months later.
And then about 2 years later, I asked Noah to marry me, and he said?
I said yes. So here we are, the Geek's Guide to Wedding Planning. Hire our friend Kat, who's a professional organizer, not a wedding planner. Saved our life. She's done over 100 weddings.
Delegate everything you can.
Use spreadsheets. Got to have a spreadsheet.
And, you know, remember, it's supposed to be fun, so have a good time.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's basically the Geek's Guide to Wedding Planning. So the Ignite organizers said that we should give a talk about how we met at Ignite and got engaged.
And I said, that's not really, there's nothing there. Like, if you're going to do it right, you'd get married on stage at Ignite in 5 minutes.
So, and we, so are. We are.
To join these two in marriage. Noah and Teresa, will you respect each other's autonomy and encourage one another's self-care?
We will.
We will.
Will you continue to investigate your inner selves, proactively share what you learn, and maintain and communicate good boundaries?
We will.
Will you treat one another as sacred, seeing each other's tender spots and knowing one another's struggles as if they were your own?
We will.
Will you each take responsibility for your actions, communications, approaching one another with gentleness?
We will.
Will you be teammates, celebrating triumphs and grieving misfortunes together? And will you stay committed to your marriage even when trouble comes?
We will.
Will you support one another in all your endeavors outside of your marriage? Will you make sacrifices to support one another and your marriage?
We will.
Will you keep having fun together?
Yes, we will!
We will.
Making space for laughter and joy? And will you strive to remember to turn off your cell phone?
We will try.
We will.
When times are hard?
Yes, we will.
We will.
Will you be present in your communities, supporting them in times of struggle, celebrating in times of joy?
We will.
And will you turn to them in times when you need support?
We will.
You all have heard Noah and Teresa's vows to one another and to their community. Are you willing to commit to helping them to uphold these vows and to support them during times of joy and struggle. Noah and Teresa, do you promise to always think of the cat and to always place her needs above your own?
Yes, we will try.
Noah, given these commitments, do you take Teresa to be your spouse?
I do.
And Teresa, given these commitments, do you take Noah to be your spouse?
I do.
Then, by the power vested in me by the state of Washington, where we have chosen to respect the rights of all couples equally, I now pronounce you married.
That does it for the tearjerker edition of Speakers Forum. Many happy returns, Noah and Teresa. I'm pretty sure that blew the top off Geek Wedding Planning. If you enjoyed tonight's talks, you can link to our series on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum, or on iTunes. We post each new episode on the Friday following the broadcast. We couldn't fit all 16 talks into this broadcast, but you'll find them online. Thanks again for tuning in to Speakers Forum. I'm John O'Brien, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.